Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Today, my guest is Dr. Brian Brooks, who is an Associate Professor of Environmental Science and Biochemical Studies and Director of the Environmental Health Science Program at Baylor University, Waco, Texas. Dr. Brooks holds a PhD in Environmental Science, Environmental Toxicology and Risk Assessment emphasis from the University of North Texas, and a Master's of Science and a Bachelor of Science in Biological Sciences from the University of Mississippi. His research interests are interdisciplinary, often integrating aspects of environmental toxicology and chemistry, applied aquatic ecology, and risk assessment to focus on the influences of urbanization on water resources. Dr. Brooks's research program has often examined the environmental fate and hazards of stressors, that is, pharmaceuticals, personal care products, endocrine active compounds, harmful algal toxins and nutrients associated with rapidly urbanizing regions, particularly in the effluent-dominated ecosystems. He's been recently working in Germany looking at similar situations, and I very much welcome Dr. Brooks today to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this is absolutely fascinating because, do you know, as a physician, and I am a pediatrician, when we prescribe drugs, we never look at the end result of the drugs. We push them into our patients' mouths and into their systems, and often it really helps them medically and symptomatically. But we never really think about the excretion of these drugs, what happens when they're metabolized in the liver, and what happens to them when they get into the sewage systems. And I guess that's really what you've been working on, as well as personal care products. And I'd like you to define, Dr. Brooks, personal care products first.
Sure. And thanks again for an opportunity to discuss a very relevant and timely topic. The acronym PPCPs, or Pharmaceuticals and Personal Care Products, was first coined in a 1999 paper by Christian Dotten, the environmental chemistry chief for USEPA, and Thomas Ternes, a German environmental chemist, in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives. And so as they defined pharmaceuticals, these could include human or veterinary medications, and then personal care products. We're really focusing on those kinds of things that may be used in soaps or detergents that have not received perhaps as much study as some of the more traditional surfactants. And so these could include fragrances, antimicrobial agents found in toothpaste, serving as preservatives in various types of consumer products.
Let's start with the personal care products first. I'd like you to just walk us through the most relevant ones that are affecting the ecosystem at the moment.
Well, it's a great question, Helen. And as it turns out, that's really where the science is developing to look at various types of approaches to screen compounds based on their likelihood or observed adverse effects in the field. And so a number of studies have focused on surfactant breakdown products.
Now, first, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you need to define what a surfactant is to the audience, please, knowing that most of us are not chemists.
Gotcha. So really focusing on the kinds of personal care products that may be of most importance is really where the science is developing. So. Uh-huh. Focusing on compounds such as active ingredients in soaps And their breakdown product, so once they enter the environment, has been a series of intensive study over the last decade or two.
Mm-hmm.
Other substances, such as antimicrobial agents that are used in toothpaste, in antibacterial hand soaps, have also received a fairly large amount of study, including a compound called triclosan, which we've been studying a bit as well. And triclosan is found in toothpaste and soft soaps. It is a fairly heavily used compound, and it no doubt has some human health benefits. But based upon some of the work that we've been doing, it appears to present relatively higher risk to aquatic life, particularly plants and algae, which form the critical basis of a food chain in many aquatic systems, relative to other, say, antibacterial or antibiotics. And so, to recap, really where the science is going with personal care products, we believe, is trying to develop efficient screening and testing approaches to identify which ones may present the greatest risk and thus may require more intensive investigation.
Well, what I don't understand, I guess, as a scientist and a physician, why antimicrobial agents or anti-germ agents are added to things like soap or cleaning liquids in kitchens and the like, because we've lived with bacteria for as long as we've been around, which is maybe about 2 million years, and that's how we develop our immunity. What is this obsession, particularly I think in the United States, with sterilization of absolutely everything, particularly in the kitchen and the bathroom? What if you culture skin normally, you find a host of bacteria that normally live on the skin. They're called commensals, and the same in the gut. So what is this obsession with killing anything that's around in terms of bacteria?
Well, I don't know if I've got the answer to it, but I do think you're onto something in that these agents are used fairly heavily in various types of personal care products. Of course, the balance of natural microbial flora are important in humans and also in terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems. And so when you study substances like these antimicrobial ingredients, I noticed that you had a recent guest that was talking about parabens, another group of fairly widely used personal care products that have antibacterial properties used as preservatives. These are the kinds of substances that are used quite a bit, but their introduction to aquatic systems appear to be primarily occurring from discharge wastewater treatment plant effluents. And so the consumer use is such that the wastewater treatment plants are not able, based upon their current design specifications, to really reduce or eliminate substances prior to entering the environment. And so the question then becomes, does the residues of these substances that are entering aquatic systems result in some disruption in the balance of normal structure and function?
Yes, it seems to me that companies add these things because they have a notion it might be a terrific idea, and then they can advertise their products. I hate that word product, but their solutions or their soaps or whatever, to say, look, this is going to kill all the germs and it will sterilize this surface and sterilize your body. But it seems to me, from a medical perspective and public health perspective, that these things are absolutely entirely unnecessary, and they're just being added at the whim of various scientists who work in these chemical companies, and they're having, as you are finding, I think, profound, probably in some cases, and certainly disturbing effects upon the environment and the ecosphere upon which our lives depend.
Well, and regarding those potential effects that these compounds may have, I think it's very important to note that one of the aspects associated with some of these personal care products and certainly the pharmaceuticals that are discharged from wastewater treatment plants is that scientists are particularly interested now in understanding whether or not our current approaches to assess environmental impacts may be stringent enough, may have the appropriate design to be able to determine adverse effects if, in fact, they are occurring. And so this becomes very important because it's, in some ways, a bit of a tools question. If anyone in their chosen profession has the appropriate tool set, the appropriate tools in the toolbox, so to speak, to be able to tackle an issue, then their chance of providing some sort of fix, some sort of prevention, obviously becomes much greater. And so much is the case, I believe, with environmental protection and conservation efforts, is that if we have the appropriate tools, whether they be scientific, technical, regulatory, et cetera, hopefully our abilities to forecast, to be able to prevent adverse effects of various types of human activities becomes decidedly increased. And so it seems to me that where the science is moving now, particularly within the context of personal care products and pharmaceuticals that are entering aquatic systems, is determining whether we really have the tools that may be necessary.
Well, it's a relatively new science, isn't it? I mean, we discovered all these chemicals and have used them in a certain sense with Gay Abandoned. And it's only recently that we've realized that, in fact, because of people like you and your colleagues, that, in fact, the ramifications at the excretion end are quite profound. I'd like you now to define, please, Dr. Brooks, what a surfactant is, so people know or understand the chemistry and what surfactants do.
Yeah, it's a great question. So a surfactant is really just a soap, and it's a chemical that oftentimes will have a water-soluble side to it, and then more of a, what we call a fat-soluble side. So my grandmother used to tell me that oil and water don't mix.
Mm.
And as it turns out, a surfactant has chemical attributes that go against that notion, in that the part of the chemical might want to stay in the water part, and part of the chemical might want to stay in the oil part. And so that actually can have some very useful applications in, say, soaps, detergents, for example. You take a shower every night, you're essentially able to use something that can be carried away by water, but that oily side of the molecule will help remove oils, et cetera, during the washing process. So really a surfactant is a soap.
And so when it gets into the ecosystem, algae and bacteria and little fish and crustaceans and the like, what have you found that surfactants actually do, Dr. Brooks?
It's a good question, and in fact, I have not studied surfactants intensively, although we have been involved in some studies in these effluent-dominated systems where surfactants are present. And so, you know, the old tenet of toxicology is that the dose makes the poison. And so, in the case of surfactants or other substances, other personal care products, other pharmaceuticals or endocrine active substances that may be present in these effluent-dominated water bodies, what becomes very important is to, you know, for the various aquatic life that may come in contact with these substances, start thinking about how an individual chemical may have more of an effect or less of an effect on different parts of a food web. And, you know, we generally would want to identify which components, pardon me, of a food web may be more susceptible to certain types of surfactants or other compounds, because then what we would be able to do is in evaluating their environmental safety or hazards, we could focus on those lower levels of impact and those most sensitive subpopulations of organisms. And we would then set that as our ecosystem protection goal.
Okay.
So the point of it is if we are not protecting the right part of an aquatic system, for example, a chemical may not have much of an effect on fish, but it may have a very dramatic effect on crustaceans or invertebrates. A chemical may not have any effects on invertebrates, but it may have dramatic effects at comparable levels on algae. And so this is the process that we would go through in trying to understand how certain chemicals, whether they be surfactants or other substances, might preferentially or specifically target and cause more dramatic impacts on different components of the food web.
Okay, so I'm just going to use my two examples of what I understand about surfactants, and then I'd like you to pose a specific example of what you found that a surfactant would affect and how a particular part of the ecosystem. But for instance, when a baby is born, a surfactant is released in the lungs, which allows the alveoli or air sacs to expand so that their surface tension is decreased, and it's like a balloon, they can blow up like a soap bubble. When babies are born prematurely, their surfactant is really not initiated, and there's a wonderful pediatrician called Dr. Mary Ellen Avery who discovered surfactant, in fact, and this discovery has saved literally millions of lives of premature babies, particularly now it's being used in China. And also cortisone can initiate the production of surfactant in a premature baby. So that's one example. Another example is that surfactant is used in the the weed killing product made by Monsanto. What's it called again?
Some sort of herbicide.
It's a herbicide, and the surfactant allows the herbicide to spread more effectively on plants. Roundup it is, but that surfactant can affect frogs because frogs have a slippery skin, a smooth mucosal surface, and when surfactant gets into the mucus on their skin, it can damage them and kill them. That's just two examples of a surfactant. But give us a specific example of what you've found in nature that a surfactant will do, Dr. Brooks.
Well, as I mentioned, Helen, I don't consider myself a surfactant expert per se, but what is certainly understood is that breakdown products of some of these soaps like nonylphenol ethoxylate, have endocrine activity and specifically can be estrogen mimics in fish.
Mm.
And so depending upon the amount of that particular product that would be used in an urban area, and thus the amount that would be broken down and then released from a wastewater treatment plant into that aquatic receiving system for the effluent, the potential effects of the nonylphenol ethoxylate particularly have been reported in the United Kingdom. Are believed to be problematic to aquatic life. And so the real question then becomes, you know, when you're looking at any type of urbanizing area and you have these surfactants and a variety of other substances that may be estrogen agonist or potentially endocrine disruptors to fish, are they actually causing the observed responses in the field, or are other substances that are also released potentially at play? And so the good news is that these surfactant metabolites are not as potent as normally excreted estrogen, 17-beta-estradiol, and its metabolite to fish. And even those endogenous or naturally produced and excreted substances are even less less potent, although they're much more potent than a lot of the personal care products, are even less potent than some synthetic hormone medications like 17-alpha-thionylestradiol, which is found in many contraceptives and other medications. And so I think the challenge to environmental scientists, if they're trying to make management decisions in these rapidly urbanizing areas, to develop approaches to identify which compounds are most problematic, and then develop hopefully technologies, other types of approaches that could reduce the release of those harmful substances at levels that are believed to be unacceptable.
Well, for instance, I've read about the Everglades in Florida and materials or chemicals that are used, I think, in the sugar growing areas, which leach into the water in the Everglades, that have estrogenic properties and that are affecting the alligators. So the alligators are born with anomalies in their genitalia. I think that the males have much smaller than normal penises, and there's some abnormality in even sexing some of the alligators because their genitalia are not very well defined, and they've been influenced by this estrogenic compound. I'm sure you must be seeing this in certain fish species where you've been looking at the effluent containing estrogenic compounds, either from personal care products or detergents, or indeed from pharmaceuticals that we excrete in our urine and feces.
Well, certainly, and this is speaking not just from my work, but also for the broader scientific community, we consider these urban areas, particularly those that we define as effluent dominated or influenced water bodies, to be potential hotspots for these kinds of endocrine active substances and potential effects on aquatic life. And so let me define an effluent, a dominated water body. And so these water bodies, certainly during drier parts of the year, will tend to have lower flows that are naturally occurring due to human use and climatic variability. And so then the amount of water that's been treated by a wastewater treatment plant that is returned to the environment, this happens all over the world, constitutes the majority of the flow in that river or stream. And so examples in the United States might include the Trinity River Basin in North Texas, downstream from Dallas-Fort Worth. In hot, dry summer months, the Trinity is almost entirely treated wastewater.
Oh, really?
From the discharges in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Of course, then that water flows down the Trinity toward Houston, Texas.
Mm.
And collects in Lake Livingston,
mm.
and then Lake Livingston provides important water supply for the city of Houston. And so these effluent dominated or dependent water bodies are some of those that we've been focusing on as model systems, because the potential for effects on fish may be more pronounced there. And so the United States, as I mentioned, certainly not alone in this scenario. There are effluent-dominated dependent water bodies in your home country, which I might mighty fond of, if I might say so myself. But then really the groundbreaking work in this area was done by John Sumter and colleagues in the United Kingdom really beginning in the late 80s and early 90s, and looking at some of the effluent dependent and dominated water bodies in the UK, provided some of the first reports in the literature of imposexed fish. These are hermaphroditic fish observed in the field. Various types of impacts on reproductive parameters. The development of at the time, newer biomarkers or measurements that can provide some indication of exposure or potential adverse effects to chemicals. And so what we're seeing in the United States, you hear reports from the Chesapeake Bay, from Colorado, from Texas, from California. The observations are new in that these studies are being performed in these locations for the first time, but are really not unexpected if one has followed what's happened in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of medical literature now about baby boys being born with smaller than normal penises or hypospadias, where the urethra at the base of the penis is not properly formed, and so there's a gap between the end of the penis where the urethra should exit, and it exits way back on the base of the penis. Undescended testicles are becoming more common, and I think we're seeing, you're seeing the results in fish, but I think we're starting to see the results of these chemicals that are being extruded into our environment by various companies and by the pharmaceutical industry through our bodies, the impacts that are being had upon humans themselves.
Well, it's a great question and comment, and in fact, with the hypospadia work, Lawrence Baskin at University of California, San Francisco, and colleagues have done really a lot of the groundbreaking work there, which I find fascinating. I think what is useful from the kinds of ecological studies that we've been involved with is that, although we do not study human health consequences as regularly as we study ecological health concerns, we can use information collected, for example, from the alligator story in Lake Apopka, Florida, or the imposexed fish story from the Thames, from the Chesapeake Bay, as essentially the canary in the coal mine, so to speak, the sentinel of potential questions that should be asked in other vertebrates. Because the important concept here, which we need to grasp and really take advantage of from a scientific standpoint, is that there is a conservation from an evolutionary standpoint of the targets, the proteins, the molecules with which various types of chemical contaminants interact, and that conservation occurs across life, and so we have now, with development of genomic data sets, studying genetics, developing the trees of life, so to speak, and understanding, genetic codes for a wide variety of species. We're just now seeing, I think, the potential to unlock that information and help us to extrapolate among organisms, whether it be an alligator or a fish or a rodent model or my daughter. And so understanding how similar the potential may be for chemicals to cause specific effects, whether it be hypospadias or hermaphroditism or neurological disorders in fish models, may be predictable from what we know about of human mammalian pharmacology data that was developed in rodent models. On the opposite side, we may be able to use fish models for biomedical applications if the question is appropriately scaled and if the target that these chemicals may have is similar, both from a functional standpoint and from a consequence from an environmental standpoint. So you're able to stand on either side of the fence, perhaps, and I think this is really where the science is developing, to say, if I have more data from mammals, how can I use that to help make environmental protection decisions? And perhaps if I have more information from ecological types of entities like fish models, I may be able to use those in supporting biomedical research.
Right. So now let's get on to the veterinary practices. Huge amounts of antibiotics now used in chickens and in sheep and in pigs and in beef, because if you give these animals antibiotics, they tend to grow faster and better, number one. So they're excreting antibiotics continuously into the environment. Number two, bovine growth hormone is often administered to cattle to increase their milk production, and that can have ramifications too within the environment and upon human beings. In fact, it seems to me that the veterinary industry, if you will, meat and chickens and all the rest, is totally unregulated in terms of using these drugs to make more profit. And I just would say another thing too, from a medical perspective, you know, we develop a lot of organisms now that are antibiotic resistant, like methicillin resistant Staphylococcus aureus, that tend to inhabit various hospitals. And when you go into hospital, you get these nasty infections, which often can't be touched by antibiotics. So the more you are exposed to antibiotics in the water you drink or in the food chain, coming from either humans or animals, the more likely it is that we will breed resistant bacteria to every single antibiotic that we've discovered, and we're left without any defense against often very, very serious infections. Do you know, Dr. Brooks, if this problem is being addressed at all in the United States?
This is a great and interesting question that I think has a couple of components to it. And so I think we are fortunate in the developed world in that there has been a lot of efforts, particularly in the United States, Canada, European Union, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, for example, to develop harmonized regulatory approaches for veterinary medicines. And those include antibiotics that would be used in various types of applications. And so, you know, that's the good news. And so there have been a lot of efforts in that area. There are also an increasing number of research studies that are examining the potential for developing antibacterial resistance in ecosystems following the use of various types of antibiotics. So whether they be in veterinary applications, runoff, for example, from a field to which manure has been applied, for example, or even just the direct discharge from wastewater treatment plants in an urban area. And so those studies are developing, and certainly more work is needed. The real question is my understanding, not really being involved in this particular line of investigation, is that the concentrations necessary based upon the current techniques may still be not sufficient to develop appreciable antibacterial resistance. However, what is important to note is that, you know, gene flow is something that is critical, as you noted, and the potential for developing antibacterial resistance in humans. Think about nosocomial infections in hospital settings. This is very serious stuff. I mean, we are observing this annually, and there have been more recent reports that suggest that there may be antibacterial resistance developing following the use of antibiotics in veterinary and urbanizing applications at more environmentally realistic levels. So certainly an area that deserves more investigation.
Yeah, that's what I've been reading too. Now, the other thing is that we live on a variety of drugs, all of us. I think in my past reading, one third of Americans are on antidepressants, for instance, and they're being found in effluent water now. And many drugs that we use, neurologically influenced drugs, digitalis for the heart, antihypertensive agents, anti-cholesterol drugs, you name it. We're really a very drugged society, partly because the pharmaceutical companies now are allowed to advertise their wares hither and yon on television, which is ridiculous because how can any patient decide what drug they need or, in fact, if they even need it? But these advertisements are very seductive, and the drug companies, as we know, are one of the most powerful lobbying groups in the United States, and they make enormous profits, which they shouldn't be doing. And so it seems to me a very important area of study regarding the excretion of these drugs and what that does to the environment and ecosphere. Can you elaborate on that a little, Dr. Brooks, please?
Sure. Well, in some of the reports that you've mentioned, we've been fortunate to be studying the topic for a little over a decade now, and provided the first report of the active ingredients in several very common antidepressants accumulating in fish tissue.
Yeah.
Downstream from these wastewater discharges. And so the topic certainly is important because we do not have, even in the developed world, where wastewater treatment infrastructure is markedly much more advanced than 30 years ago, for example. When was the last time that we heard about rivers catching on fire in developed countries? So the good news is we've made great advances in the way that we manage our waste and our wastewater. But for things like pharmaceuticals and personal care products, these substances just aren't removed once the discharge enters the environment. And so I think it's important to have a couple of perspectives here. Now, first, the reason why we're detecting these substances that are released from wastewater treatment plants is because advances in analytical chemistry have allowed us to develop, incredible instruments that allow us to detect substances down to a part per trillion or lower. So imagine a part per trillion is, you standing in a field surrounded by a trillion of your closest friends. And so the technology advancement over the last couple of decades has been nothing short of fantastic and makes for our potential identification of environmental contaminants to really be unprecedented.
Mm.
So then that provides opportunities for these kinds of studies. And so the second perspective really is that, how does certain types of pharmaceuticals enter into a wastewater treatment plant? Can we nip the problem, so to speak, in the bud prior to wastewater being collected at a municipal location? And so some studies, although there haven't been very many, but several studies have tried to proportion the number of or the amount of waste loads for pharmaceuticals that are excreted from your body naturally. So, for example, just getting an over-the-counter medication or something like Dr. Caldicott might prescribe to you. And so then that's going to enter your body Most of the time you're going to take that orally, and it will be excreted when you use the restroom. Depending upon the drug class, it may be excreted as a largely unchanged form of the drug. But in many cases, it's metabolized to some degree into these metabolites that then go into a regional or municipal wastewater treatment scenario. Now, that is believed to represent the majority of the loading of medications to wastewater treatment plants. However, there are scenarios where unused medications may be discharged directly down the toilet. In fact, we've told folks for years to dispose of unused medications by flushing them down the commode.
That's true.
And
yep.
And what federal agencies are now realizing is that there may be more appropriate ways for disposing of some of these unused medications. For example, packaging them in with coffee grounds or cat litter or whatever, and sending it to a landfill where at least it has a chance to break down over the long term in more of an environmentally benign way than direct discharge into a wastewater treatment plant. And so some medications are not recommended for disposal to a landfill. In fact, they're if there's a high abuse potential, for example, a kid getting a hold of a drug, which of course we know is a serious public health issue, then those may still be recommended for disposal down the toilet. And so, you know, really the loading of medications to these wastewater treatment plants is going to be largely from just excretion after a patient takes the prescribed or over-the-counter medication, but some portion, perhaps up to 15%, 20%, may be from direct disposal down the toilet.
Now, so what have you found with the metabolites and actual compounds of antidepressant drugs? Can you describe the effect upon fish and algae, et cetera? What actually have you discovered?
We have been studying several antidepressants over the last few years, several widely used compounds. We had reported in an article in Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry in 2005 the presence of the active ingredient in the antidepressant Prozac and its primary metabolite, which is called norfluoxetine. The main drug is fluoxetine. And then we also detected the active ingredient in the drug Zoloft, which is sertraline, and its active metabolite desmethyl sertraline, in three different fish species residing in a stream downstream from a wastewater treatment plant here in the North Texas area. And so we have then also been examining how those substances may affect aquatic organisms. And so they will, like most substances. The question then becomes the dose at which the organisms are adversely affected. Mm. And in the case of these compounds, and it may be the case for a number of other pharmaceuticals, it really gets to the kinds of biological measurements that are being made. And so to give you an example, let's say that you perform what we would call a risk assessment for a chemical, and you're concerned about the substance potentially causing an impact on your family. Well, if the regulators don't take into account the potential carcinogenicity or the potential for that drug to cause cancer, and consider it a non-carcinogen, it may be that if in fact the chemical is carcinogenic, that the acceptable level of the compound would be much lower. So it gets back to this concept of how you study the potential effects of a substance, and do you have the appropriate toolbox, the appropriate tool set? And so know, in the case of this cancer-causing agent example, you would want to have data on the potential carcinogenic effects, and also on potential other effects, whether they be effects on your heart or your et cetera. And so, much is the same when we are studying pharmaceuticals in the environment, in that we are focusing on potential impacts that make a lot of sense and have been historically studied. For example, if a fish can't survive, then it's probably going to be adversely affected by that level of a drug. If a fish can't grow, then it may not make it to reproduction status, and ultimately the population of the organism could be adversely affected. And so those kinds of responses of organisms have been traditionally studied. But some of the things that we've been doing, as well as others, are focusing on what would be considered non-traditional endpoints, or using new tools to understand how organisms may also be affected.
Mm.
So in the case of the antidepressants, we've been particularly studying feeding behavior, because in fact, the way that these antidepressants work is they work on a neurotransmitter called serotonin, and particularly they block how serotonin moves around in your nerve cleft, and that ultimately has the beneficial effect. Well, that effect may be observed very similarly in fish models.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we've shown that there's a very strong similarity between where something like Prozac may interact with the fish brain and how it may work in the mammalian brain, for example, in a rat model. And so we've then further started looking at feeding behavior, because feeding behavior is very ecologically relevant. If the organism cannot consume enough fish, then it may not be able to grow and ultimately reach a reproductive success stage. If an organism is not able to escape predation, then the population of that prey offspring may similarly be adversely affected. And so the question then becomes, are we using the right kinds of tools to study these pharmaceuticals in the environment? And we feel that focusing on responses that are associated with how the drug works in you and I, in mammals, may provide insights on the kinds of responses that we should be looking for in critters like fish, which biochemically and from a molecular biology standpoint sometimes are not too dissimilar from us.
Well, what does it make the fish do, Prozac? Do they eat more? What happens to them?
No, they will actually decrease feeding rate.
Ah.
So they'll actually consume less prey per unit time. There's also a paper that has recently been published that suggests that especially not just individual chemicals, these antidepressants, but especially low-level environmentally realistic mixtures of these antidepressants can actually adversely affect the ability of the organism to escape predation, potentially.
They get too sort of drugged out and happy and not scared enough to escape a predator.
That's right, and of course, I guess I've been associated with the happy fish comment in the past, but in this case, the organism's behavior is just not that of the untreated control,
yeah.
And so its ability to catch the prey appears to be reduced. It may be that fluoxetine, for example, the active ingredient in Prozac, has some effects on appetite, but unfortunately, we really can't dissect that. We don't have a microphone to talk to the fish, so to speak.
No.
And so we're not able to understand whether that's happening. But what we do know is that feeding behavior appears to be a more sensitive endpoint, and yet highly entirely ecologically relevant relative to some of the other tools that have been used in the past.
Yes.
So,
The other thing, before we've only got about 6 minutes left, there are two other subjects I want to address. One is we use a lot of radioactive isotopes in medicine. For instance, radioactive iodine is used A, to diagnose thyroid disorders, and B, to actually treat thyroid cancer in quite high doses. And what we don't look at very clearly, I think, is that a patient can continue to excrete radioactive iodine in their urine for about 10 days after that they've had their I-131 drink. And that, of course, then passes into the sewage system, as do many other isotopes that we use in medicine. And I think that, as far as I can see, hasn't really been addressed adequately. Would you like to quickly comment on that?
Well, I'm actually not as familiar with that particular example, but there have been some studies that have been performed on various types of medications, cancer medications, for example. But you bring up another point, which I think is pretty interesting, related to, you know, after a drug administration, how long it takes for a drug to clear the body. And so, as you know, certain drugs may be contraindicated based upon their clearance time. Basically, it takes some time for levels, physiological levels of a drug to be low enough so, for example, it wouldn't disrupt the metabolism of another drug, say the level of the liver. My grandparents are taking some medication, and they're not supposed to be eating grapefruits right now because of the same potential for some metabolism disruption. And so, example might be Prozac, okay, this antidepressant, fluoxetine, which is contraindicated with propranolol, a beta-adrenergic heart medication. And so, and the reason is because it takes really about 2 weeks for fluoxetine to be cleared from physiological levels before a physician may prescribe something like propranolol. And that's because fluoxetine will inhibit some of the enzymes that metabolize propranolol. And so subsequently, if you were to co-administer both substances, you continue to take the heart medication, propranolol. If you're taking Prozac, propranolol will build up to a level where it would actually start causing problems for you. And so one of the real questions that is just now starting to be explored with the topic of pharmaceuticals in the environment is, you know, this notion of mixtures and how, you know, mixtures are part of our lives, especially in, you know, with the advent of chemicals and whether it be residues on your apple, whether it be low levels of a wide variety of substances in your drinking water. And so the challenge of understanding mixtures is really upon us, and what are the potential consequences of mixtures of drugs that act through the same way or drugs that are contraindicated on aquatic life living downstream from wastewater treatment discharges, particularly for those responses that are associated with the pharmacological effects of the drugs, really deserves more attention in the future.
Yes, well, I think this is an absolutely fascinating subject, I think, and it's in its embryonic form yet, Dr. Brooks, that there's so much more work to be done. We live in a chemical cocktail of about 80,000 chemicals in common use every day, and only five of which are tested per year for real carcinogenicity. I also think that the EPA has a huge responsibility to get onto the sort of work that you are doing and pioneering in this area, and we must become, all of us, much more aware of, I think, the chemical cocktail in which we live, in the air, in the water, in the plastic bottles that we drink our liquids from and the like. So I really thank you very much for introducing us to this complex but fascinating and terribly important subject, Dr. Brooks.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to a fascinating interview by Dr. Brian Brooks, an Associate Professor of Environmental Science and Biochemical Studies and Director of the Environmental Health Science Program at Baylor University. I thank you for listening to If You Love This Planet, and I think as you become regulars to the program, you'll be learning more and more about science and what it's actually doing to our environment. And I think it's imperative that we all understand these issues so that we can make the world a better and more healthful place. That track was Secondhand News by Fleetwood Mac. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back again next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.